Hello everyone, a very warm welcome to you. I'm Aisha, your host, and I appreciate you tuning in to the very first episode of The Nonprofit Bookkeeper. In this episode, we're flipping the script. A friend of mine is taking the interviewer's seat, delving into my story and providing insights into what this podcast is all about. And along the way, we drop some tips as well. So stay tuned to discover more about me and the essence of this podcast. Hello, B. Thank you for joining me on the Nonprofit Bookkeeper today. For the benefit of our listeners, Obi and I have worked together for over 20 years in the nonprofit sector and have become friends. We bounce ideas off each other from time to time. Yeah. So thank you for being with me today, Obi.
Thank you so much, Aisha. Can you believe it's more than 20 years we've been in the sector? You remember when we started? More than 20 years ago. Yeah. And I'm glad to be on your platform.
Thank you, Obi. And just to say that what I hope to get out of today's conversation with Obi is to share with listeners my journey in the nonprofit sector. Yeah. So, where did I start?
Where do you start? Where do you start? So when we mentioned it 20 years ago, though, what were you doing before 20 years ago, Aisha? So maybe we could start from there. What do you think?
I was studying, a lot of studying, and I was doing a lot of temp work in the accounts department, in the finance field, I should say.
In the profit sector or non-profit?
It was mainly the profit-making sector, funny enough. So I had about 10 years working in the profit-making sector as a temp, being sent to different organizations to do things like bank reconciliation, purchase ledger, things, sales ledger. And I vaguely remember I took time off to have my youngest. I had my mommy with me at the time. I'd left my son at home and was on the bus. And I remember being on the bus and driving past a building and thinking, I'd like to work there. And to be honest with you, I had no clue what was happening in the building because the building had no signs on it, which was really weird. And it might have been just the area or I don't know. But anyway, a few months later, I think it was, I was sent to that same building.
Manifestation.
I was sent to that same building to do a 1 week assignment as a purchase ledger clerk. And guess what? I ended up being in that same building for 10 and a half years.
Oh my God. So what do you think was So you went for a week and then you ended 10 years.
Yeah.
What do you think was the drive? I know you well enough over the 20 plus years, but do you want to talk about why you think they kept you on beyond 1 week, even though they only needed you for 1 week at that stage?
At the time, the 1 week assignment was to help them fill a vacancy. And when, with me being there, I applied for the vacant role of purchase ledger clerk. And because I was overqualified for the role, I was quickly getting through the work and asking for more advanced things to do. And obviously, there was room for me to take on those additional things. And yeah, so I did a lot of that. And then the management accountant at the time went on maternity leave and I stepped into the role during her maternity leave. So I was basically maternity cover of the management accountant role. I think that must have been about just coming up to a year after me joining. So I was there doing what she used to do, with supervision from the head of accounts at the time. And the management accountant then came back. So I covered the role for about a year. And she came back. And the role of the assistant management accountant was created for me.
Okay.
Because we had somebody in the purchase ledger clerk, and they were conscious that if what I was going back to was a purchase ledger clerk, more likely than not, I was going to leave. So the role of assistant management accountant was created for me. Okay. And so that's what I was doing, supervising staff, supporting with management account functions. And the management accountant decided she was going to leave. She wasn't how it is with when you have a baby, you don't want to, especially when they're young, you don't want to leave your kids and stuff.
I think it's one of those things that probably your listeners might actually recognize in terms of having a baby and then being in such roles, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And back then, we didn't have all this flexibility with regards to work patterns, and you're either at work or you're not at work. So she chose to leave. And the opportunity then came up for me to step into the role. I did. And that was how I became the management accountant of the organization. The setup of the organization was you had a management accountant UK and a management accountant international. And the management accountant UK would deal with the internal departments and the subsidiaries. They're now called subsidiaries, but they were then called recruitment bases. And those recruitment bases were countries like Netherlands, Canada.
Okay. Some European and some North American locations. Okay. Yeah. Okay.
And the international management accountant work with the program funding team within the UK and with the country offices. The organization had quite a few offices around the world. I guess what kept me there for so long was every time I felt like, oh, I've reached the peak of my learning in the role, something new was dropped in.
I think it's what letting people know that there's something, some characteristics of what you have, and you haven't actually said anything about it. You talked about how the role might have been, you were overqualified for it. It's just that you seem to have ability of absorbing more responsibilities because you enjoy the responsibility element of things. And as a result of it, the organization could see the skill set that you bring along, they could see your interaction, they could see your professionalism, and they're like, actually, even though they hadn't noticed that there were more work to be done, the clarity that you bring to work, in some cases, might come across as in, oh, she's detailed oriented, but to be detailed oriented has resulted in organizational understanding the gaps. And that is one of the skill set that you're able to see what those gaps were. And even as long as 20 something years ago, you were already identifying in an organization saying, wow, we really want to keep this person on because we could see the benefit they bring on board. So I think it's good for people to actually know that is one of the innate skill set that you have is that ability to keep on accessing for more and aspiring for high quality. And that is one of the things that when you stepped into the management accounts, it was okay, hey, there's no need going out to go find somebody else because you have somebody already that qualifies based on experience to be able to do that role. Mm-hmm. I think it's worth saying that. I know you're not going to say that, but it's just to make sure that it comes out there. I have worked with you long enough to be able to say, okay, I testify to that.
You know me well enough. I'm not good at blowing my own trumpet.
Definitely.
You know,
not.
And you and I have spoken about how these days that's something we have to do more of, but it's, I'm getting there. but it's not, it doesn't come naturally to me. Yeah. Just going back to the question you asked, what you asked was, why do I think they kept me on for so long? And I'm wanting to talk about why I stayed there for so long. And for why I stayed, it was more because at every point in time, I felt like I had reached the peak of my learning. Something new came on board. So there was managing difficult staff. Staff was literally handed over to me because they felt I had more the right temperament to deal with it. And there was doing internal audits. There were all sorts of stuff that were not originally in the role. And like you alluded to, Obi, it was felt that, oh, Aisha can do that. And I suppose part of it is because they identify the fact that I'm very keen to learn new things and open to it. And I was fortunate to have a manager who will sit with me. Even with the technical things, we will sit together and she'll explain to me. So that was really great. And so that was one of the things that kept me there for so long, because I was always learning. That's the need. I don't know if it's a need, but I love to learn new things. And especially when one is in an environment conducive for it and you have a manager who supports it. Coming out of that, one of the things with having that manager is I've gone on and emulated, because I really appreciated what she did with me. In all my future dealings, I've carried the same approach with people I've worked with. And
I think that's really great to see you when... This is one example of you stepping into an organization that you went there for a week that turned into 10 years. You're starting this podcast. Hopefully it will be something and then it turned into 50 years.
Very funny. Very funny.
It's that whole thing about your characteristics of able to stay on. You have the energy to, it's not just dabble into something and then you walk away from it. You dabble into something because you've done your research. It's something you like. And if you like it, you stay on it. But just going back to that organization, which kind of felt like from my knowledge of you was your stepping into a proper foundation for not-for-profit. You and I worked within the same organization, which had something like over 40, 50 countries' offices globally, and of which they had things like, when we talk about country offices, this is where the main unit of the office is based in the UK. And then we have offices in the Global South, and we have offices in the North, right? So we're looking at Africa, Asia, Caribbean, and the rest of it. During that time, you did have opportunities of visiting those countries. When you did, what were the kind of responsibility you held, or what was the requirement for your visits to those countries?
Okay. My visits were mainly internal audit visits, and that's internal audit, basically reviewing the systems and making recommendations around what could be improved. And in some cases, working with the team to help them to improve the processes they were using. And one of the key areas that stick out for me in the visits were around managing donor funds. And because there was a process that was used in the UK, because the grant agreement was held in the UK rather than the country offices. So the terms were very clear to the UK team and may not necessarily have been too clear to the country offices. that was one thing that was very clear when I went into a few of the country offices, sitting down with them and explaining to them, this is how it should be done. The reason is, this is what we're hoping to get out of it. And this is how. So that was one thing. And the other thing, some of the other things included things around exchange rates, segregation of duties. Segregation of duty is very easy to say when you're talking about large organizations, but when you're in a, when you're a country office that has two or three staff members, or maybe two or three office staff with a lot of volunteers or people working in the field, it may not be that clear as to how segregation of duties can be incorporated.
So it's quite great. You've touched on something that I think hopefully we'll try and explore as we go along. That is talk about donor compliance. And with the organization having the headquarters in the UK, and back in the day, contracts were being signed through the UK, and then it wasn't necessarily distilled completely to the country offices. So the country offices just acted on the program side of things, but not seeing that. And of course, you talked about the exchange rate and you talked about segregation of duty. Do you have any fun stories of your findings that you might, you don't have to name names, but do you, maybe you got lost on your way to the office, or maybe that there were things that you found in the office, or there were there things that, you know, I know this is you trying to explain, but I remember in one of the work I did, I found alcohol was being charged, but the name of the alcohol was put on the invoices. So if you didn't know what the local alcohol was, you couldn't tell that it was an alcohol, but because I knew what it was, you would be able to identify that. But it wasn't so much that they were trying to, you know, circumvent the system. It's more that they hadn't been thorough in terms of what they were putting across. Do you have any stories of interest that, or things that people might be thinking about? It might not be stories that you really want to share because you being typical of not wanting to expose certain things, but are there things that you think you could, or what people might be aware of or think about when they're doing audit from Global South, going to country offices that they've never been before, not even knowing anything about the location?
I suppose what I want to draw attention to here would be, there's one thing about carrying out an audit and having the textbook, this is what a receipt should look like, or that is what is expected. But there's something else to be said for, you got to take the country context into account. So sometimes it's not so much about, this is what the book says, you have to have a receipt. And coming from UK, you're expecting a receipt printed on letterhead with an invoice number, with everything printed. And then you get to the country office and they either say, oh, there's no receipt, the taxi doesn't give receipts, or it's a slip of paper that's all rumpled up and almost looks like something that's been picked off the floor. And what would generally happen when I come across situations like that would be, have a conversation about what are the alternatives. I do get it that you might not have a system where you can get receipts like it is in the UK, but you could either carry a receipt book with you and get people to sign, or have the office have a self-declaration form and set limits to say, who's incurred the cost, details to what the cost is, and they sign a declaration saying that the expense has been incurred solely for the purpose of business. And of course, for those sort of things, you have to set a threshold, because as we all know, expenses need to be what's the word, authenticated by providing evidence. But then when you think about the country context, sometimes if there is a policy, and these are things that come with building it into your policy rather than just saying, oh, on this case we do this and then next time we do something else. So that was one thing that was common across board most of the countries I visited, because the cultures don't allow for, oh, you go to the shop and you get a sealed receipt or that sort of thing. And a cab driver would not necessarily be someone who is literate enough to say, here's a receipt.
Now that makes sense, because like you said, some of the goods that you're purchasing is from traders that actually have not educated enough to be able to write anything down. Mm. Or if you go to a local, very local restaurant in the middle of nowhere, the chances are they never even a pen or paper to be able to write anything down. So, or you're on a motorbike or on a bicycle in some cases, and then you're not able to, or if you're lucky enough to be on an elephant in, in South Asia, then because like you alluded to, the organization you started off worked in quite some of the countries that were locations were remote in terms of the work they were doing. Yeah. So when you talk about donor compliance, though, and I think it's quite fine to be able to mention specifics. Are there specific donors during that time you reviewed and you thought, oh, these are quite interesting donors in terms of their requirements?
What I found was most of the government funding, like U.S. State Department, the EC, funding had very stringent requirements. And because of that, you would find a lot of attention was put on ensuring compliance. It was almost as if offices were treating, oh, this is EC funding, we have to do it this way. That is some other funding, they're more lax with it. And so one of the things I'm just going to take a step back. And it's interesting to find that even now that I no longer work as an employee so much in the sector, I'm finding that with the local government funding as well, their requirements are also stringent, so much so that they're asking for all the original receipts to be sent back to them. I'm like, that's interesting. Yeah, just going back to what I was about to say, one of the things I tried to do when I left this organization we're both talking about was, rather than two different systems, what I tried to do is build policies that encompassed the whole thing. So whatever the policy is enough to meet both the government funding and the other sort of funding the organizations will have, because then that makes it easier. You're not trying to remember which type of funding this relates to or that what that one relates to. So, yeah.
Okay. Fantastic. I do have a follow-up question. You said you tend to stay in an organization and you learn, and then you stayed in this organization for 10 years. So why did you leave in the end, and where did you go?
Okay. So at the time I left, I had this urge to leave the UK and go back to Nigeria. Because, just by way of background, I was born in the UK and my parents took my siblings and I back to Nigeria when we were quite young. And we all grew up and then came back to the UK. And at that point, I just had this, it just felt, I want to go back to Nigeria. And
Do you think, sorry to jump in, do you think we could get back to this question I asked you, but maybe just give us a little bit, now you started, give us a little bit flavor of family and then why you went into this accounting, and then we could come back to this question. Let's just do a detour.
Okay, family, one of six, the only girl and the second child. How did I get into accounting? I don't know, to be honest. I completed a degree in business administration when I was in Nigeria. And when I returned to the UK, I did a degree in accounting and then went on to do a master's in finance and administration.
Okay. So you like the numbers, though?
I do like the numbers. I've always had a flair for numbers. I love maths. And I was fortunate when I was in primary school to have a teacher who saw my love for numbers and nurtured that. So not to say that accounting is maths. That love for numbers has always been there.
So you have a love for numbers. You have attention to details. But I also know that you love reading a lot of books, though.
Oh, yes, I do.
You get into trouble because sometimes you read more of your books than other stuff, right?
Yeah, I do love reading books. And
what kind of books do you enjoy reading?
It's been a journey of sorts. When I was younger, I guess it was more the romantic books. And I had the James Hadley Chase. I had Jeffrey Archer. Legal dramas. But now I find that I can't read any of that sort of book anymore. I'm more, my focus is more on business development, personal development. And I can't actually read a book, actually. I have to listen to, I have to listen on Audible, which is an interesting fact because I buy all these, I used to buy a lot of books, but now I've realized that there's no point. So I just listen. But then there are times I listen to books and the reference resources and ask you to go to some websites related to the book. Yeah. And I never get to go to those websites. And then I think, actually, I'm going to buy the book so that I can annotate and highlight and whatever on there. So I have a few of those sort of books. Yeah.
No, it's interesting because all this combines to being, like we said, being an accountant is not just about numbers. It's being able to write your management report, is able to get information to the end users, but also make it readable. So it's not like in the 60s where accountants are the ones that have got ties and black jacket and sitting in the basement. They're more like your average Joe on the street that you don't even know. So yeah. So if we could jump back into the other question that I had earlier, which is then to do with why you left where you went.
Okay.
And I think you started off letting us know that you wanted to go back to Nigeria. So now, you've told us that you wanted to go back to Nigeria. But then what happened? Did you go back to Nigeria?
No, I couldn't get a job in Nigeria. Okay. I got a job with another UK charity. I was based in the Gambia. When I got the job, I thought, Gambia is West Africa, so it should be, I'll go to Nigeria.
You could walk across.
Yeah, that's what I thought. You know how I am, with geography. So I thought, I thought, that's easily done. I can easily get to Nigeria. And I just jumped at it and obviously found out that's not the case. It's difficult to travel within, it's more difficult to travel within Africa than internationally. I mean, from Europe to Africa back then. I don't know what it's like now.
Yeah.
So I took up this role and I was responsible for finance and basically the operations of the country office.
What was the role called?
It was called Senior Finance Manager. But it's exactly what I did as the Finance and Operations Director in the last role I worked. And I guess the job titles differed across organizations, but more or less the responsibility for finance and the operations of the office sat with me. And that was where my journey started, of taking responsibility for the operations of an organization. And when I first got in country, the first responsibility was to complete a donor report. And I hadn't done one before. I had never
You audited, but you haven't actually done it yourself.
Yeah, I hadn't done one myself before. And I guess that was the first. Obi was sat in the program funding team in the organization I left. And I'm like, Obi, help me out. So I sent an email to him. Like, so that was interesting. But more than anything, in the organization I'd left, the one Obi and I were working in, there was a lot of things I was doing, but I had an HR department behind me. So if I needed to make any HR decisions, they were providing guidance. I had IT department. If my team had issues, I would go to IT. So I had a team behind me, but in this role, I was on my own. I literally had to figure it all out. And from figuring out donor reporting, country regulations, how does it... So I couldn't have gone in and said, oh, HR has got to be done this way. I had to look at the country laws. What does it say? I see. I know this is what I want. These are the things that need to be in place. But I'm not an IT specialist, right? So I had to speak to the service providers and say, okay, these are the things I'm thinking are needed, and have conversation as to why they could be had or why they couldn't or why they don't apply in the country context, because there's lots of reasons. It could be some of the things I'm thinking about are not available in the country, or it's not required, or the infrastructure isn't there to actually provide those things. And there will be a discussion around, okay, what other control measure could we have in place? So, yeah.
And this was one of those, although you had spent 10 years with this other organization, the one you spent 10 years in had quite a lot of expertise and experience and standardization to a level. But this one you worked in my understanding, were quite different. So there were more autonomy in the national offices than a UK standard following of financial management.
Then, to a certain extent, there was, even though the structure they were following was meant to be the one provided them by the UK. But then, of course, within the country context. And that is where coming in and trying to figure out how do things work in this country. And even though things work this way, the interesting thing is, okay, so one of the things, there were no staff contracts. Staff contracts had expired. Some of them are tied to projects. The projects had ended, they were still on. Or maybe they were given an initial 6 months contract that had expired and nothing had been done about it. The staff advances, that was a staff advance. If it's an advance, it gets deducted from your next salary, right? But you have staff advances that have been paid on for a year, for years, and that's a loan. And even the country law says, if you're giving your staff loans, it's a benefit in kind if you're not charging interest. And obviously, we all know that there are implications, tax implications to them. So I have come in and trying to put everything in line, and people were not liking it. And that's what, and this is what I say to people I've worked with over the years, is that's why you have policies, that's why you have laws. Yeah. So even when, you know, people are not happy about it, you're like, it's not my fault. It's the policy.
This is what the law says.
This is what the law says. This is what the policy says. I didn't make the law. I didn't make the policy. So we got to stick to it, and that sort of thing. One of the other things that I found, not just in this office, across a lot of the offices I worked outside of the UK, you had the staff loan issue, you had the partner advances as well, without any controls. You give a partner an advance, they haven't accounted for it, and you give them another one, and it quickly becomes a huge balance sitting there unaccounted for. So it was...
Do you want to explain what a partner advance actually means? What is a partner advance?
Who's a partner? A partner would be an organization, and I guess it differs from organization to organization. How you define your partners could differ. But in a lot of cases I've been involved with, a partner might be a small organization who is engaged to deliver an activity. So I've got a funding from a donor, and I've said I'm going to deliver A, B, and C activities, but I'm not going to deliver them myself. So I have a partner, for example, might be a training, and maybe a partner organization is going to deliver that training on my behalf. That organization is my partner, implementation partner in some cases. Yeah, in most cases, they're implementation partners. So for that activity, maybe I have £5,000, for example. So I might give them, depending on the arrangement. You might give the partner the whole £5,000 up front, or in most cases, you give them a proportion of that £5,000. And when they've delivered a certain part of the activity, the idea is they report back, provide receipts, evidence that they've delivered the delivery or that part of the work.
They've made that delivery, yeah.
Yeah, and then you release another tranche to them. And that's what it is. But in a lot of situations, what was found is the partners just come back and say, oh yeah, it's time for the second tranche, and there's no accountability for the first tranche they've collected. And there might be partners on more than one activity, so it gets even messier, because you have two or three activities that they haven't accounted, that you just keep giving them tranches of funds for. And then you have this whole thing. And when it's time to report to the donor, everyone is running around. So some of those things I put streamlined that a bit and was like, okay, so one, we got to clean the backlog. Two, before you collect another tranche of funds, you got to account for the first advance. And that's something I implemented in all of the offices I eventually went on to work, because it was pretty clear to me from that first office, the mess it creates when you don't do that.
Fantastic. So far, we've talked about an initial journey of UK, of which you were based in the UK and you traveled to other country offices, did some audit. Mm-hmm. You talked about your management accounts. You talked about the supportive work you did. Now, you've talked about your initial flavor of being in a developing country, working context, specifically working with partners in country. You've talked about donor compliance. So you talked about donor compliance initially in terms of having a contract and then ensuring that they've met it. Mm-hmm. Now you've talked about donor compliance in terms of actually developing the report itself. So you've graduated in some of the learnings. So you've talked about the learnings you've had from that first one and the second one. Mm-hmm. So the idea, just this conversation, is about your journey. Mm-hmm. So what then happened after Gambia?
After Gambia, I got the state of the books to a place where the UK directors were happy. But because there were issues in a few other offices, they wanted me to go to other offices. And they also knew that my original intention was to go to Nigeria. I think they had a consultant in Nigeria, and they had a few vacancies before they brought the consultant in, and the consultant was leaving. So they're like, oh, Aisha, do you want to go to the Nigeria office as well? I'm like, oh yeah, of course I want to go to the Nigeria office. But before I go to talk about the Nigeria office, there's something I want to talk about. I was in the Gambia as an international staff, and I was there on my own, literally, because I didn't have my family with me. And what that meant was I was working literally 24/7. Because I was using work to while the time away. And occasionally when teammates had time or they could squeeze me in to their weekends away with them and go explore the town and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. Obviously, I'd made friends there and there were other international staff there. I would go out with them. But for the bulk of my time, I was working. And that was how I was able to clean up a lot of the stuff. And I think there's something to be said for me being a workaholic at that point in time. I wouldn't say at that point in time, because it's carried through all the way till recently.
I'm just murmuring there.
It's only now that I'm trying to, and I note the word trying, to get some sort of a work-life balance. Anyway, so one of the reasons I thought I'll mention that as well is because I'm hoping to interview other people who are international staff and see what their journey is like, and those who go without their family and those who go with their family. Okay, so then I went to Nigeria. A similar sort of thing, processes, procedures needed to be implemented, properly implemented, with streamlined controls put into place. Again, interesting, difficult to an extent, because people were resistant, but again, it was always the policy and the country laws. No.
Yeah.
So yeah, similar.
Would you say there was a big lesson for you between Nigeria and Gambia, or Gambia actually prepared you enough to be able to do the work you did in Nigeria?
I think Gambia prepared me. And yeah, one of the things I had to do, especially with the partners, when I arrived there, some of the partner managers will come in and say, "Oh, hi, I'm whoever from this partner organization." And I had to say to my finance manager at the time that you deal with them. I don't want to have to, unless it's absolutely necessary, you should deal with any questions they have. And if you're not sure, speak to me. What that allowed me to do is maintain a distance and be able to put my foot down when it was necessary. And I think some of them felt it was arrogance, but that's what I needed to do to get the work done. Because my view was, yes, it's always nice to come away from a place with friends and all that, but I was there to do a job.
You maintained their professionalism throughout. And that was key for you.
Yeah, it was.
It feels like manifestation works a lot for you. So you went past a building and then you worked for me for 10 years. You left that, you said you want to go to Nigeria. You ended up in Gambia and then the next thing you went to Nigeria. If I could see manifestation always, things in your thing is just coming out that way. And I think there's another manifestation that as we go along that will be happening. As
I never thought about that.
I go past, there's a building there. Yeah, I would like to know what's in there. There's no sign, but the next, you know, you're there 10 years after. You're in Gambia. So your journey seems, you know, you started in the UK, you went out, you did the job, then you got an opportunity of doing audits. You ended up going, I know we haven't mentioned it, but we ended up going to South America, going to South Africa, going to quite a few countries, which you enjoyed. But at the same time, I think you've alluded to that you're a workaholic. So even in some of those travels, you didn't get an opportunity of seeing the country because you were working. And then you wanted to get that result, which also, I think a lot of your personality in this conversation is coming up. You're dedicated to get a result. But you're dedicated to get, and not just a result, but you want to make sure that all the I's are dotted and all the T's are crossed. Your personality in that and in your attention to details. So then you've done Gambia. Now you've done Nigeria. Then what happened next?
Before I talk about what happened next was, Obi ended up in Nigeria in the same town I was as well. And he had come to set up a charity organization. I'm like, oh my gosh. And I must say that was where we actually we did share ideas a lot, but I think that was the point at which our friendship actually developed. So, I don't know if that's the right way to describe it. Because I was in Nigeria on my own, working all the hours. You were also in Nigeria on your own, working all the hours. So we worked all the hours again. But we then started going to, because they had opened a new cinema in the town, and we'll go to the cinema. We both love watching films, so we'll go to the cinema. Sometimes we'll have the theaters to just the two of us sitting there. I'm like, oh my gosh. Yeah,
I'd like to mention, though, that you've already said it in this conversation, so I'm not just saying it, but your sense of geography and direction has not been attention to details.
No.
Because all your arrival, for 2 years before my arrival, you still didn't know how to get to places, right? Do you want to talk about that?
No, don't. Definitely not. Definitely not.
We save that for an internal joke.
Yes. So I then went on. I left Obi in that town, and I returned to the UK. And I returned for family reasons, but the organization decided to keep me on. And in the role I held in the UK, I was supporting offices like Malawi. What were the other offices?
Ghana, as well.
I think the Pakistan office as well. I think it was the Bangladesh office. Bangladesh. There were a few countries that I supported, and I actually was embedded in the Malawi office for a few months. On more than one occasion, I went into the Malawi office to work with the team there. Again, similar thing, improving systems, closing the year, supporting the finance team. Again, there was a lot of cultural, oh, I can't say this to them because they're older or they're the manager. Again, or they're men, coaching them, coaching the team and referring them to use the tools they have at hand. And these are qualified accountants, I must say. Use the tools you have at hand. You have your policies, you have your, you have the country laws, you have your professional standards sort of thing. And so use the, those are tools for you to use. So, yeah, so those were interesting times. It was just interesting to find that similar sort of patterns across different countries, similar patterns in the sense of that even though so, in the sense that the need to improve the systems.
But there's something to maybe to dive into, because if you have spent 10 years or part of your 10 years supporting an audit here, and then you've, at this stage you're talking about you have spent probably about 5 years in Ghana, Nigeria, and you have found details, changing systems, improving on existing systems, educating people, coaching, and the rest of it. Why do you think there's still that gap? Why do you think that gap exists? And why do you think there's that still that sense? Because subsequently, in the other jobs that we were touching, there's still a gap within national offices. What do you think is... I know you've talked about it, how there's a level of confidence, different gaps, and this is why these people are not sometimes able to challenge those things. What do you think can be done? And because it's almost like a perpetual spinning wheel that will, you know, people like you or I will come in and we'll help and we'll help. But then you go back again to help and you help. But you go back again and you help and you help. So why? It's almost like it's an everlasting support that you're going to be doing, and how do you think it could be changed?
I think you're right with what you say, and I think part of it is a generational thing, because I believe that the younger generation tell you when to get off when they need to tell you when to get off. They don't mince their words, whereas I don't know which one is the millennial and
Gen Z.
The earlier generations, anyway, there's a lot of respect. There's a lot of, oh, I can't say this, I can't say that. And as long as that generation remains in the workforce, I feel like that is going to be, it will be a recurring thing. The need to go back and support them and coach them and tell them this. Whereas the younger generation, I think, are more confident. They voice, you know, in voicing what they think to a larger degree. So hopefully we'll see a shift in the right direction in the coming years.
I think what I like about where the sector is heading and they have started is about nationalizing almost every role. So even if you're international and an accountant and you want to work in a country office, you would be on the national staff salary type of thing. So whether you work for the big Oxfam, Save the Children or whatever it is, they're creating this nationalization approach where it's more nationals doing the work, not nationalization from political, but where you're looking at it from more nationals. doing the work. So hopefully with, you know, the ethics and standards of accounting being perpetuated through people, that we might be able to maintain that. But it is quite, during our stage, it seemed to be that wheel of, you spend 3 months and then you're going back again after a year, and then you're correcting the difference between the last time you and the next time. Okay.
Yeah.
So then that was the UK. That was, so you're back in the UK. They kept you on. Same, the same story with you. They want to keep you on. They kept you on. And then you worked on. But during that time you were abroad, what happened with the family? What happened? You said you were there on your own. So do you want to mention anything about your children during that period?
It was a somewhat... Okay, so my daughter was in uni, but she had to pull out for mental health reasons. And that was a really tough and difficult time. Had to make some difficult decisions. She eventually came over to spend some time with me in the Gambia and then returned to university. And thankfully, she's okay now. And in a way, I often say that I guess something about the silver lining in it, that I'm glad for when it happened in the sense of the care she had. Either at the time, mental health issue wasn't commonly spoken about, or it wasn't as rampant, so she was able to get a high level of care. So I don't know if it's a matter of it's not being rampant and not many people know, but it was definitely wasn't as commonly spoken about as it is these days. But so thankfully she's okay. Still, my son had gone to boarding house in Nigeria and returned to the UK. And he was one of the key reasons I returned to the UK, because he wanted me back in the UK, and he kept going on and on. And after a while, I had to give in. And okay, I'm coming back. And in a way,
But go ahead. Thanks for sharing that. I think it's quite important for people to note that the mental health challenges and people face, the impact on families themselves and impact on the individual. And I'm glad that, you know, you confidently mentioned it, because sometimes in the past it's been a taboo to actually say that somebody has it, or a member of my family or your family has it. So just letting people know that it is a human nature for things to happen. And then, well, gladly, your daughter is doing well. She's performing well. And she has a coping mechanism, and that has also opened a lot of other people's eyes in terms of what you need to do to be able to handle some of those things. So thank you very much for expressing those and sharing it. Yeah, so back in the UK, now I'm tired of this other work. Or I have done everything I needed to do. I've worked in their country office. I'm back in the UK. I must say that you were also the forefront of work from home back then, because I think it was once in 2 years in the office, maybe once a quarter. But yes.
Yes, I was.
That was way before COVID as well.
That was way before COVID.
You were working in London, and it was somewhere up Midlands. Okay. Yeah. So you finished with them, and then what happened?
And then I thought, it's time to move on. And I got a job with another charity. Needless to say that. Let me keep on with this, and I'll go back to the point I wanted to make about working in the charity sector. So I went to this other charity, actually took a pay cut, but was going to be working again as a finance and operations director, but in this case would also be working with trustees, in the sense that I'll be servicing the finance committee, reporting. At the time, the structure of the organization was that I would also be delivering the financials to the board, as well as the finance committee. And that for me was new. So I felt, that's an opportunity to grow. Also, apart from the charity receiving donor grants, they also were a grants-giving organization, which again was somewhat new. Not necessarily, if you think about the work, the work I've done with the country offices who were giving grants to partner offices. But so again, responsible for compliance, IT, building management, primacy, you know, the whole suite of operations of the charity. And in this case, I was also going to be submitting reports to Charity Commission, the whole company secretarial sort of role, even though I wasn't a named company secretary, was carrying out those duties. So I thought, this is something different. Let's go for it. And it was interesting for me that when I had the interview, one of the things that was said to me at the time was, because I told them around my about my work arrangements, the arrangement of working from home and going in once a month, or I can't remember if it was once a quarter. And somewhere in the interview, we're not going to let you work from. It wasn't as blatant as that. It was basically that, no, you can't work from home. You're going to have to come into the office. I'm like, okay, yeah, I'll come into the office. I'll come into the office. You know, especially as the office was in London and I was living in London as well. So I was like, okay, yeah. So, yeah, so I moved into this other organization. The CEO had joined, I think, a few months before I did. And so it was nice to actually learn the organizations together. I don't know if that's the right way to describe it, because she was also learning the organization. I was learning, and I've come in and I'm saying we need to do this. But obviously, as the CEO, she's listening to all the staff. Again, this organization is an organization that was a growing organization that had a few policies they had outgrown. So I've come in and I'm saying, no, you can't do this. No, we have to do this. You can't all have the password to the server. You can't all do this. You're sticking passwords on your computer screens, all those sort of things. And again, being met with resistance. Oh, we want to do this. When we travel, we go on trips, we come back with foreign currency that cannot be converted to anything once you bring it into the UK. And I'm saying, no, you got to change your money. Anything, you change it or we write it off as an expense against you again. Oh, why is Aisha doing this? Why is everything changing? But over time, we were able to get some new policies, updated policies in place, and people saw why. I don't just come in and say, no, you got to do things this way. Having discussions with people, explaining why it's necessary, showing them the impact of what's been done before and why it needs to be changed and things like that. But we're all human. We don't like change. Right? So it was somewhat slow going, getting these things into place. But the trustees were on board. And some of the things, the CEO was like, okay, reluctantly. But then when she started attending some CEO conferences and they had finance sessions, and she would come back and say, oh my gosh, Aisha was so far ahead of a lot of the other organizations. So there was an appreciation for what I was doing.
Yeah. Just for listeners' pleasure, when you talk about exotic currencies that people are coming back with, why is it an issue? Why would you consider deducting it from people's salary or telling them to convert it? What is the issue behind that?
So let me correct that. I wouldn't deduct it from their salary.
No, I'm not. Okay. Yeah, no, I know what I
mean, though. But the reason being...
But we would deduct it if they don't actually... It as a loan.
So if I went to... Let me think of one currency that... Okay, so the main currencies you can convert...
Malawi Kwacha, for instance.
Okay, so let's talk about Malawi Kwacha. If I went to Malawi and came back with, say, 10,000 Kwacha, right? I don't know how much that is. Let's assume that's maybe £500, I don't know, which probably isn't, but let's assume that's £500 worth of kwacha sitting in the petty cash tin, because I can't bank it. I can't do, I can't change it to GBP or euros or any of the, to any of the, I don't know, what do you call those currencies? The main currencies? I've forgotten there's a term for.
Like a hard currency or something like that.
So I can't change it. So it's just going to sit down there. And if I don't have anyone going from the office to Malawi, that £500 just sits down there and it's of no value. So that would eventually be written off as a loss. In some cases, and this is something that actually happened, in some cases, the currencies were changed and what we were holding was no longer a legal tender. So even the chance of somebody who was going out there taking it with them was removed because that money is now worthless. So that's why there was the need to have people change money back before coming.
I think just allow you to cough and have some water. I completely agree with you. And I think sometimes if you're on the program side and not on the accounting side, it's something that people are not aware of. It's almost like, I give it to you, that's my change, you know, I've reconciled and I've brought you by the currency, so why, what is it, go change it. But like you said, they forget completely that even when they go back the next time, the value of the currency has already changed the moment that they've left the country. Moment to moment, the currency just goes up and down, and those local currency against the hard currency of GBP, GBP tends to hold its value against those things. Like you said, if it was 500 kwacha, by the value of that is no more the value of that when, you know, again, but it sometimes is a conversation that the non-finance people don't understand. You know what? I got into country, I changed my money, so I don't understand. Luckily, it seems like some of these things are changing as banking grows, so where people can actually use their credit cards locally. But yeah, but coming back with them exotic currency is quite something else. Okay, so now you've talked about the UK organization, and again, just to summarize quite a few things. So at the very beginning, you were doing more like purchase ledger, you were doing sales ledger. And you got into doing management accounting. He became as the management accountant. He did a bit more audit. He did a field visit. He did stock count in some cases during the time. Then you moved on to looking at compliance, but from donor compliance. There were also compliance in terms of ensuring that we're meeting all the UK legislations. Then you went into national offices, and then you did a whole suite of organizational management, which operational management, which was beyond just accounting. So that was your big delving into IT, even though you had a qualification in secretarial something.
Corporate, what it used to be called chartered secretary, but it's now called corporate governance.
Corporate governance,
yeah.
So, but then that gave you opportunity of that thing you studied to actually get your hands into negotiations and dealing with suppliers directly. So you did that, but now you also got into more donor compliance. Now you're looking at the USAID. Now you're looking at, you know, what's it called? DFID. They called our UK aid now. You looked at the European Commission, EC, Irish aid. You looked at also the WASH. But you also started looking at project specific things during that time as well. So now that were quite a lot of experiences that you gained working in country office. Then you've come back to the UK. And now, because you've already had that UK experience, you now started adding it. Because now you're doing the finalization of the report that goes to
preparing the report, actually
preparing and submission. And this will be your first time of actually owning that full responsibility. You supported them all that. So this new role in the in London allowed you to look at the SOP, the finalizing submission, Company House Charity Commission. It gave you opportunity of working, liaising with the board directly and presenting management information, not just management information to staff members, but management information to the board. It looked a lot at compliances. It looked at doing the company secretary role and things like that. But you also looked at registration with the US, what's it called, where you had to disarm for each of those projects. For the organization, right?
Yeah, that's an annual thing, if I remember right. That had, you had to re-register the
organization.
The organization to maintain, was it? To maintain the ability to
get funding from the US government.
Yeah, that's right.
So you had to submit some of those documents. Okay. So again, I'm summarizing it just so that people have a flavor of that, because this was at the junction of after this job that you've decided that I have got 20 plus years of experience, so I'm now going to do, please let me know, what was it that you decided?
I decided I was going to set up my own company and start supporting charities and just businesses, basically. With their finances. And and that was about 2.5 years ago now. About 2.5 years ago now. I set up Bookkeeping, Accounting and Consultancy Services Limited. Called it Bank Services. So that's the trading name. And it's been an interesting journey, because I set out thinking, I know how to do the books. I set out thinking that the business was going to immediately kick off. And little did I know that my technical skills is the least of what I need.
For starting a business.
And nobody ever tells you. You see everybody, I'm running my business. And I'm like, okay, I'm going to run my, I've always wanted to anyway. And I thought, okay, let's do it. This is the time the kids have flown the nest. I've reached a place where I feel like I can make a go at it. And realize that there's marketing to be done. And I think my experience so far, I think that is the key thing to the survival of any business, because you have, the technical knowledge is important. But if the business is not known, then, you're not going to get the opportunity to utilize that technical skill. And one of the things I tell people now is, if you're thinking of starting a business, even before you step away from whatever it is you're doing, start putting yourself out there. Start talking about whatever it is your business is going to be about. Maintain, build a network, both in person and these days social media is key. You got to put yourself out there. I'm not necessarily one for putting myself out there or for even talking to people, but I've had to learn. I've had to step out of my comfort zone. In my previous roles, obviously we had, especially because of the roles I held, I had to attend meetings, I had to go for conferences and all that. And as an example, as with most conferences, if they say the program starts at 9 a.m., 9:30 is going to be kickoff. You have coffee at 9. You have coffee and mingling from 9 a.m. to 9:30. I wouldn't appear at the event until 9:35. So that I don't have to leave. She was straight at this. And now I think, if only I had. But that was me. I've had to say, it's just not in my nature, but I've had to learn to do it a lot of, because the first time I had to pitch my business, my voice was shaking and but I'm getting better and I continue to learn every day. Anyone who's thinking of setting up their business, They got to start putting themselves out even before they get to that stage of where the business goes live.
Would that be one of the key lessons that you would want to give people? As much as, like, I know your technical ability is always a requirement. If you don't know what you're doing, then of course you can run a business. But then the main thing you're saying is the marketing and the visibility of your business is one area that do you think is more for you based on your personality, or do you think that would necessarily be the key area of challenge within businesses? So if you are someone that networks quite easily and the rest of it, do you see there could have been other areas that would have been required?
I think every business, the first thing is marketing. Okay. And I have spoken to a few other business owners and, you know, and it's the same thing. You know, a common phrase is people buy from people they know they can trust, and they can only know you if you've put yourself out there. The likability comes from them getting a sense of who you are. And over time, they'll build a trust if you're consistent with who you put yourself out there to be. Because obviously, there's only so long you can pretend for. You know, so I think that's my personal view. Others might think otherwise, but I think marketing is key.
I just have a few more to wrap up, but I just list them, so it's on you to decide how you want to do that. The key one I wanted you to also talk about is why you're doing, you've mentioned it, you've alluded to it, you said that you're the people that you want to be getting on your platform. Why are you starting it now? What is the benefit you're hoping to get out of it? And finally, anything that you feel like you wanted to talk about that we haven't touched on. So those three, choose how you want to do that. So the idea is, why did you set up this? Why now? And what was the thing that you want to get out of it? Well, so you've explained
a
bit of it, but
yeah. So the other thing with the podcast, so obviously I've mentioned how long I've worked in the nonprofit sector. And in that journey, in all the organizations I've worked with, the focus has always been on the mission, rightly so. However, it always felt as if some organizations call it programs, some implementation, whatever name it is, their needs was, I don't know how to put this.
More, it's almost because the back room is, as they say, the
finance and operations.
It's not as important as a programmatic thing.
Exactly.
And they're not generally recognized because.
So, and I felt that actually there was a need to shine a light on them as well, because I feel that the work the back office functions do upholds the program team and upholds the mission itself. Because, for example, without the finance team to manage finances, or even the fundraising team to work on raising funds, or, you know, maybe even the grants team, the grants making in organizations that give grants, so the grants team managing those grantees, without all these, or even IT or HR doing what's necessary, things are going to fall apart. And the delivery of the mission will be very shaky. So I thought I'll use this platform to shine a light on all those back office functions and service providers who provide those sort of back office functions as well.
I think it's really worth mentioning that, and a good thing in part of the closure of the conversation, indicating all that you've explained with the over 20 years and 25 years probably combined, just the two of us, we're looking almost 50 years. And we do know errors that have been made when we've looked at things, and how those errors could easily if not corrected, or if procedures we didn't put in place, would have actually impacted significantly the deliverable of those things. The fact that partners are able to get their funds on time to do those activities, the fact that based on the audit, so if any of the institutional funders did an audit, we're not paying back anything. You and I have been in an organization where there have been experiences where the unrestricted funds that we had was actually used to pay for mistakes that were made because the compliance wasn't followed. And we're talking about thousands of money that was wasted because a vehicle was purchased without following the right orders that should have been used, which then meant that the funds that could have gone to other stuff. And again, without you highlighting this in this conversation, nobody sees them. Beautiful workshops are being delivered, whether it's about gender, whether it's about human rights or whatever, but it's those forefront events that are being seen. It's great that you're mentioning it.
You get it, and I hope our listeners get it as well.
So finally, for me, just to say thank you for the opportunity to actually participate in this journey.
I really appreciate you coming on to do this with me. I want to introduce myself to listeners, and I didn't think talking for so long would do the job, and I felt that you were well placed because of the relationship we have to do this with me. Thank you. I think you've done a good job.
Thank you, everyone. I appreciate you for tuning in and listening till the very end. Now that you've got a glimpse of who I am, moving forward, the focus will be to shine a light on the often unseen and unheard of efforts of back office teams and functions. I believe their work is crucial in enabling the execution of activities and the realization of nonprofits' missions, and they deserve to be spotlighted. Make sure you follow the Nonprofit Bookkeeper so you know when the next episode becomes available.